June 5th, 1997. San Antonio, Texas. Police receive an anonymous phone call from a man who claims that 44-year-old Monica Rizzo has been murdered by her husband, Leonard Rizzo, and that her remains can be found in her backyard. While a search of the property turns up nothing, investigators learn that Monica has not been seen for weeks, and there are allegations of abuse in her marriage. 1 month later, a new search of the Rizzo's backyard turned up over 200 bone fragments which belonged to Monica, but while Leonard is suspected of killing her, there is not enough evidence to charge him, and the murder is never solved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a case which I've been wanting to cover for a long time, the 1997 murder of Monica Rizzo. This story was once featured on Unsolved Mysteries and involves a woman who went missing while trapped in what was alleged to be an abusive marriage to her husband, Leonard Rizzo. Acting on a pair of anonymous phone calls, the authorities would eventually discover over 200 small bone fragments scattered throughout the Rizzo's backyard, and given that Leonard was living there at the time, you would think this case would be pretty cut and dried, right? Well, not so fast. The initial DNA analysis concluded that none of these bones belonged to Monica, and a second round of testing would conclude that they belonged to Monica and three other unidentified individuals. Needless to say, this threw the entire case for a loop, and it would be at least 2 years before more advanced testing finally confirmed that yes, these bone fragments all belonged to Monica and Monica alone. However, this whole situation caused a lot of complications with the investigation, and while Leonard was still considered to be a suspect, the authorities have felt that the case against him is not strong enough to file murder charges. And even if Leonard did this, there are still a lot of unanswered questions about the circumstances of Monica's death and how her body was chopped up into hundreds of pieces. It's an incredibly bizarre case that has managed to remain unsolved for nearly 27 years now, so we're finally going to tackle it on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. As our Patreon page has around 70 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on a regular feed. In addition, I wanted to announce that this coming Saturday, April the 27th, we'll be holding one of our Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathons, in which I screen classic segments from the show, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. It's taking place at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and if you'd like to join us, you can find the link to our screening room in our show notes, as well as pinned to the top of our social media pages. So with all that out of the way, let's now delve into the murder of Monica Rizzo. Our story begins in San Antonio, Texas in 1997, and our central figure is 44-year-old Monica Louise Rizzo. Monica was originally born in Germany and was adopted by parents Bill and Monica Hilda McKinney. The couple originally met while Bill was stationed in Germany with the U.S. Army, and since the elder Monica was unable to have children, they decided to adopt a newborn German girl, name her Monica as well, and then take her back to the United States to become a naturalized citizen. For the past 26 years, Monica has been married to her 45-year-old husband, Leonard Rizzo, and they currently live together in a house in a middle-class neighborhood on Forest Green Street in San Antonio, only about 3 blocks away from where the McKinneys live. The Rizzos have 2 sons, 22-year-old Leonard Jr., who resides in his own apartment, and 19-year-old Vincent, who still lives with his parents, and Monica works at the Department of Human Services. On June the 5th, the San Antonio Police Department received a phone call from an anonymous man who informed them that Monica Rizzo had been murdered by her husband, Leonard, and that her bones could be found in her backyard. The police soon went to the Rizzo residence to check this tip out, and when they arrived, Leonard Rizzo Jr. was there, and Leonard Sr. was lying on the couch and appeared to be experiencing a seizure, so he was rushed to a local hospital. When police questioned Leonard Jr., he said that he had been visiting his father when the seizure began, and it wasn't uncommon for Leonard Sr. to experience them. However, Monica was not at the residence, and Leonard Jr. confirmed that he had not seen or spoken to his mother for over a week. Police performed a search of the house, but found nothing to indicate that Monica had taken off, as her car was parked in the driveway and her clothes were still in her closet. When they checked the backyard, they did find some bones which turned out to belong to an animal, but did not find any human bones or any evidence that foul play had taken place. Vincent Rizzo was not at the house when police arrived, as he worked at a movie theater, but it turned out that earlier that same day, Leonard Sr. had sent Vincent to his grandparents' residence to see if they knew where Monica was. Investigators soon learned that Monica had not shown up for work at the Department of Human Services for an entire month. On the morning of May the 5th, Leonard had called Monica's business line and was unable to reach her, so he decided to call up the office's receptionist and screamed at her to get his wife on the phone. When Monica learned about this, she was horribly embarrassed and apologized to the receptionist before she left the office. It was initially assumed that Monica had gone out for lunch, but even though she left her purse behind, she never returned. Over the course of the next 8 days, Monica's supervisor tried to call her at home several times without getting any answer. When she finally picked up on May the 13th, Monica told her supervisor that she was not feeling well and would be taking the rest of the week off, but planned to return to work on the 19th. Well, Monica never showed up, and even though her supervisor kept making phone calls to the Rizzo residence, no one answered. When police spoke to Monica's co-workers, they expressed their belief that she was a victim of domestic violence. They claimed that prior to her disappearance, she would show up to work with bruises on her face and her arms, and appeared to be losing weight at an alarming rate, weighing as little as 85 pounds at one point. In fact, on April the 8th, after Monica missed 2 days of work, one of her co-workers became concerned enough to contact the police and ask them to perform a wellness check at the Rizzo residence. When an officer knocked on the front door, Monica answered by partially opening it, and he saw some noticeable bruises on her face and neck. However, Monica completely downplayed them, saying that she got the bruises during an accidental fall, and assured the officer that everything was fine before closing the door. Even though Monica had not been seen at her workplace for a month, her son Vincent graduated from high school on May the 25th, and numerous witnesses recalled having seen both Monica and Leonard at the graduation ceremony. 2 days later, on May the 27th, Vincent said that he woke up at 5 a.m. and used the shower. He claimed that he soon heard Monica's voice in the bathroom, as they both joked about the fact that Vincent had gotten up early for nothing because he mistakenly thought he had to go to school. Vincent said that after he finished showering, he went back to bed, but never saw or heard from his mother again. Since Vincent often worked long shifts at the movie theater, which ran past midnight, he did not initially find it unusual that he never crossed paths with his mother, but it turned out that between the early morning of May the 27th and the phone call to the police on June the 5th, there were no other confirmed sightings of Monica. Bill and Monica McKinney had not seen their daughter in quite some time, and were perturbed when Monica did not even phone them or send them a card on May the 11th, which happened to be Mother's Day. When Vincent informed them that he had not seen Monica in over a week, they could not understand why Leonard never attempted to report her missing, and it was Bill who took the initiative to contact the San Antonio PD to file an official report. While Leonard was recuperating in the hospital, Bill paid a visit to the Rizzo residence and was shocked by how messy it was. He discovered that Monica's passport, driver's license, and social security card were still there, which made him believe that she did not take off voluntarily, and he feared that something bad had happened to her. When Leonard recovered from his seizure, he was questioned by police and told them that sometime in late May, he had woken up at the house and discovered that Monica had just left. Even though Leonard didn't know where Monica was, he said he never attempted to contact the police because he figured she would just come back eventually. Well, even though Monica had now officially been reported missing, investigators did not have much to work with, and there was no evidence that a crime had taken place. However, 1 month later, on the morning of July the 4th, the San Antonio PD received another phone call from the same anonymous male. He once again informed them that Monica had been murdered and that her remains could be found in the backyard, only this time he said they were covered by a blanket and hidden under a pile of tires by the fence. Two detectives paid another visit to the Rizzo residence, and while no one was there, they were able to reach Leonard Jr. on the phone, and he was able to grant them consent to search the property in his parents' absence. This time, after looking behind a pile of tires in an area next to the fence with overgrown weeds and sunflowers, detectives found a human skull, several bone fragments, and two garbage bags containing what was believed to be human flesh. When police performed a more thorough search inside the house, they discovered it was in complete disarray and that a section of drywall had been smashed and had spatters of blood on it, indicating that a violent struggle had taken place. When Leonard was questioned about the whole situation, he claimed to have no idea how the skull, bone fragments, and bags of flesh wound up in his backyard, and expressed his belief that someone had planted them there in order to frame him for something. He also said that he had personally caused the damage to the drywall, as well as the spatter of blood. Leonard claimed that Monica's disappearance had left him so angry and stressed out that he had an emotional outburst which caused him to start punching holes in the wall and headbutting it. He also denied the allegations from Monica's co-workers that he was physically abusive towards her and had caused the bruises they'd seen on her body. According to Vincent, on the day that his father was released from the hospital following his seizure, the first thing he wanted to do when he returned home was screw a 2x4 over the entrance to the attic on the ceiling in the garage. This compelled police to remove the 2x4 and search the attic, but while they found nothing, luminol tests of the garage would turn up possible traces of blood on the floor beneath the attic's entrance. The San Antonio PD decided to bring in a team of archaeologists from the University of Texas to perform a full excavation of the Rizzo's backyard, and they wound up discovering a ton of additional bone fragments, which they believed were only a few weeks old. Over the course of an 8-day search, the team wound up collecting over 200 bone fragments, most of which were less than 3 inches long and had no soft tissue attached to them. The bones had been scattered throughout the yard so much that some of them were found in the barbecue grill, as a possible attempt may have been made to burn them. The archaeological team believed that a piece of machinery, such as a wood chipper or shredder, would have needed to be used in order to chop up a victim's body into that many small bone fragments. But even though police performed a search of the businesses in the area where machines like wood chippers could be obtained, no evidence was found to indicate that Leonard had ever owned, rented, or operated one. DNA testing would be performed on the bone fragments and the skull at the privately owned Gene Screen Labs Incorporated in Dallas, but the results took everyone by complete surprise. Not only did the remains not belong to Monica, but they likely belonged to at least 2 or 3 different people. This prompted the police and the archaeological team to perform an additional search of the Rizzo's backyard with cadaver dogs, and they wound up discovering dozens of new bone fragments, some of which were believed to be from human toes and fingers. The Rizzo residence would be dubbed the Little Backyard of Horrors by the media, but once again, Leonard claimed he had no explanation for how all these remains wound up on his property. Since Leonard was known for being a motorcycle enthusiast who liked to hang out in biker bars, one rumor which was circulated throughout the area is that he killed several people in hopes of garnering membership into the outlaw Bandidos Motorcycle Club, but this theory was quickly debunked. In late August, A new round of reverse DNA testing was performed on the remains by Gene Screen Labs Incorporated, and DNA samples were supplied by Vincent and Leonard Jr. This time, a DNA match was made to some of the remains, which seemed to indicate that some of them did belong to Monica, but the results also indicated that some of the other bone fragments belonged to three other people. This only served to cause further confusion for the investigation, and since the remains which matched to Monica were very small, she was not yet declared legally dead. In fact, Leonard would publicly express his skepticism with the results of the new DNA analysis and told the press that he believed Monica was still alive somewhere. However, the McKinneys felt certain that Monica was dead, so they held a memorial service for her in September, but since they refused to invite Leonard, Vincent and Leonard Jr. would not attend. The McKinneys showed no hesitation at telling the media that they believed Leonard was responsible for their daughter's death. They said that they never really liked Leonard and had merely tolerated him, as they felt he was often controlling, possessive, and jealous towards Monica. According to the McKinneys, the marriage had really started deteriorating when Leonard lost his job during the fall of 1996, as he didn't seem to show much desire to find new employment and was relying on Monica to support the family. The case would receive national exposure when it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired on November the 13th, and Leonard agreed to be interviewed on camera in order to deny any involvement in Monica's death. While the segment never mentioned this, it turned out that the San Antonio PD had finally identified the anonymous male caller who had advised them to search the Rizzo's backyard on two separate occasions. He was a family friend named Robert Hakala, who said that he paid a visit to the Rizzo residence sometime in late May and spoke to both Leonard and Monica. However, when Hakala returned to the house 3 days later, he said that he detected a foul odor and saw a small dog in the backyard playing with what appeared to be a human jawbone. Hakala noticed that the jawbone appeared to have overlapping front teeth, much like Monica did, so he came to believe that the jawbone belonged to her and that she had been murdered by her husband. For some reason, Hakala did not want to contact the police directly and instead made an anonymous phone call. When their first search of the Rizzo's backyard failed to turn up Monica's remains, Hakala called them again 1 month later to provide more specific details about where the bones could be found. In May of 1998, Sergeant Daryl Voles of the San Antonio PD's Homicide Unit told the press about an odd conversation he had with Leonard at the house on the day that the first set of remains were found. According to Voles, Leonard told him that if he can guarantee a sentence of 10 years probation without any prison time, he would reveal everything that happened. When Voles informed Leonard that the police were not authorized to make such a deal, Leonard instead gave a written statement in which he denied any involvement in Monica's disappearance and death. For his part, Leonard denied ever asking for such a deal, claiming that the police kept telling him that he would receive a lighter sentence if he confessed to Monica's murder. Another detective also said that when he told Leonard that the circumstances of Monica's presumed death did not constitute capital murder, he gave off this odd reply, quote, "Maybe I ought to go kill someone else." Well, in June of 1998, the Rizzo family would experience another tragedy when Leonard Jr. died of leukemia at the age of 23. In January of 1999, Vincent Rizzo would finally move out of his parents' residence when he married his girlfriend, and they both enlisted in the United States Air Force. A few months later, Leonard Sr. was evicted from the house for non-payment of the mortgage, but by this point, he had become involved in a relationship with another woman named Susan McDaniel, and they both moved into a mobile home together. However, on May the 29th, police responded to a domestic disturbance call at the trailer, as Leonard had violently attacked Susan with his fists and a hammer. Leonard was arrested and charged with assault with bodily injury, but was released from custody after a friend posted bond. When Leonard returned to the mobile home, he got into another violent altercation with Susan, so early the next morning, she ran off to a nearby convenience store and used a payphone to call the police. Susan asked if they would accompany her back to the trailer so she could collect some of her belongings, but when they arrived, Leonard pulled out a handgun and a standoff ensued. For the next 4 hours, police surrounded the trailer while Leonard pointed his gun at them, and even put the weapon to his head to threaten suicide. Finally, When Leonard fired off a shot into the air and then pointed his gun at a member of the SWAT team, the officer shot him in the lower abdomen. Leonard was then rushed to the hospital, and after receiving medical attention, he wound up pulling through. According to Susan, before their first altercation, Leonard had been on a methamphetamine binge and had not slept for 3 days, and when he flew into a violent rage, he threatened to, quote-unquote, kill her, chop her up, put her in a garbage bag, and bury her. Leonard claimed that he was set off when Susan told him she had seen Monica alive somewhere and would not share any more specific details. Well, just over 3 weeks after the incident took place, it was publicly announced that the skull and bone fragments found in the Rizzo's backyard had been sent to the Air Force Institute of Pathology in Maryland for more advanced DNA analysis. The results confirmed that the conclusions from the original DNA testing were erroneous, as they can now say with absolute certainty that all of the remains were Monica Rizzo's and none of them belonged to any additional people. This finally cleared up a lot of the confusion in the investigation, and the authorities can now say for certain that Monica was the victim of foul play and release her remains to her loved ones. A box containing Monica's bone fragments was laid to rest at Mission Burial Park South, and while Leonard was still incarcerated in jail at this point, he was granted a temporary release to attend the funeral, though he would still be required to wear his orange jumpsuit. Even though Leonard had been charged with a number of different offenses in relation to the incident at his mobile home, he only wound up being convicted on a single aggravated assault charge and received a 2-year prison sentence. Leonard was released in May of 2001, but shortly thereafter, the McKinneys learned that he had taken out a $100,000 life insurance policy on Monica prior to her death and was hoping to collect on it. Even though Vincent was aware of this policy, his father had told him it was only for $10,000, so after receiving encouragement from his grandparents, Vincent filed suit against Leonard, arguing that he was entitled to receive the insurance money. The McKinneys were hoping that the matter would go to court and possibly force Leonard to take the witness stand and testify under oath, but the two sides ultimately agreed to a settlement before this could happen, and it's believed that Leonard wound up receiving 60% of the insurance proceeds minus attorney's fees, while Vincent received 40%. Believe it or not, Leonard also applied to receive Monica's state employee benefits from her time at the Department of Human Services, but the Employees Retirement System of Texas informed Leonard that since he had not been ruled out as a suspect in his wife's death, they could not pay him these benefits until all pending criminal investigations had concluded. While Leonard responded by filing a lawsuit against them, he was dismissed by the Texas 4th District Court of Appeals. While the authorities still believed that Leonard was responsible for Monica's death, the Bexar County District Attorney's Office did not believe there was sufficient evidence to file murder charges. Sadly, Monica's mother, Monica Hilda McKinney, passed away in December of 2010 at the age of 86, without receiving any answers about what happened to her daughter. However, just under 1 year later, in October of 2011, Monica's father, Bill McKinney, released a book about the case titled The Raw Truth, which provided an extensive account of Monica's troubled marriage to Leonard, as well as her subsequent disappearance and death, and the McKinneys' frustrating attempts to seek justice. After nearly 26 years, there's still no conclusive answers about how exactly Monica was killed, and her murder remains unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Well, I'm willing to guess that if any of you listeners came into this episode without having any prior knowledge of the case, your eyebrows probably raised when you heard that a missing woman's chopped up remains were found in her own backyard while her abusive husband was living there, and yet somehow, this still wasn't enough evidence to charge him with murder. However, if you followed this case from the very beginning, you might have a good idea of what a huge, complicated mess this is. Yes, it's definitely reasonable to assume that Leonard Rizzo killed Monica Rizzo, but as someone who watched this case on Unsolved Mysteries back when it first aired, I can tell you that I initially had no idea what to think. The story was originally featured on the show in November of 1997, only about 4 months after the bone fragments were found in the Rizzo's backyard, and at that time, the most recent round of DNA testing had concluded that the bones belonged to Monica and three other people. So while I was definitely suspicious of Leonard, this whole conclusion left me scratching my head. Who were these other three victims? Did this mean that Leonard Rizzo was a serial killer who killed multiple people? If he was, how did he manage to chop up all the remains into such tiny pieces without anybody noticing? And it's worth reiterating that even though law enforcement had already figured out the identity of the anonymous caller who informed them about the remains in the backyard, they never mentioned this on Unsolved Mysteries. As ridiculous as this whole situation might sound, I was willing to consider the possibility that perhaps there was some serial killer out there who murdered Monica and a couple of other people and decided to scatter their bones in Leonard's backyard in order to frame him. Of course, now we know that the original DNA analysis was flawed and those bone fragments only belonged to Monica, but you can imagine how much this situation complicated the investigation. Theoretically, if Leonard was ever charged with murder and brought to trial, his defense team could attempt to generate reasonable doubt by bringing up these errors with the DNA testing in order to convince a jury that the case against Leonard was heavily flawed. So in preparation for this episode, I did read the book The Raw Truth, written by Monica's father, Bill McKinney, and it's definitely one of the most heartbreaking and frustrating books ever written by the family of a murder victim. I believe Bill is still alive, though he would be in his 90s by now, but it sounds like the past 26 years have been a living hell for him, as he has lost his wife, only daughter, and one of his grandsons, and he has never wavered from his belief that his former son-in-law got away with murder. From reading the book, it's clear that Bill and his wife never liked Leonard Rizzo from the first moment they met him. Leonard had originally met Monica when she was only 17 years old, and the McKinneys felt that he was a lazy drifter who did not like to work and was often supported by his enabling parents. At some point during the mid-1970s, Leonard became involved with the Pagans Motorcycle Club and wound up being arrested for dealing drugs. But he made a deal to testify against the other bikers who were arrested alongside him, which meant that he received a short sentence in a minimum security prison. Leonard's criminal record would also be expunged as part of the deal, so this meant that when he became a suspect in the murder of his wife 2 decades later, the authorities were unaware of his prior troubles with the law. In spite of these issues, it sounds like things were going fairly well with the Rizzos during the 1990s, as they were living in a new house, Monica was working for the Department of Human Services, and Leonard even got steady employment at the Camp Geary Job Corps Center in San Marcos. However, when Leonard lost his job during the fall of 1996, it sounds like things really started to go downhill in the marriage, as Leonard made very little effort to get re-employed again. I get the impression that even though he was relying on Monica's income, Leonard was also resentful about the fact that his wife was supporting him financially. It's worth noting that even though the McKinneys believed that Leonard was a controlling and possessive spouse, they did not seem to have any idea that he was physically abusive towards Monica until she went missing, and they started hearing all these stories about bruises being seen on her body. And while it sounds like Leonard was always a not-so-great husband, I'm not sure he actually became violent until around 1996 or 1997. At the time, the Rizzo's youngest son, Vincent, was still living at the residence, and while he never told his grandparents that he saw his father abuse his mother, Vincent's girlfriend later informed the McKinneys that he had told her about witnessing domestic violence in the household. It also appears that Leonard was unfaithful during the marriage. At one point, Leonard had a trailer in the backyard which he said that he used as an office, but when Bill McKinney went into the trailer following Monica's disappearance, he discovered that it contained a bed covered with blood and bodily fluids, a number of sex toys, and drug paraphernalia, meaning that it was essentially used as a party trailer. While Leonard was incarcerated, Bill uncovered a series of letters which he had written back and forth with a woman named Julie during the fall of 1997, after Julie was arrested and sent to prison for possession of methamphetamine. Their correspondence began only a few months after Monica went missing, which meant that Leonard either got over his wife's disappearance remarkably quickly, or he had been carrying on an affair with Julie while Monica was still around. The ironic thing is that during the same time period, Leonard was still telling the media that he did not trust the DNA analysis and believed that Monica might still be alive somewhere, yet he and Julie were discussing their future together after she got released, which seems to indicate that he knew Monica was never coming back. I have no idea how this relationship ultimately turned out, but we know that by 1999, Leonard had become involved with another woman named Susan McDaniel, in which he violently attacked her in a meth-induced rage, supposedly during an argument over Monica, and then he wound up getting shot during a standoff with police. This is far from the only case I've seen in which someone became a suspect in the murder or disappearance of their spouse, and then went on a complete downward spiral in which they self-destructed and got into trouble with the law for other reasons. So if nothing else, this whole incident paints a very unflattering picture of Leonard's character. It sounds like Vincent Rizzo has shied away from the spotlight when it comes to this case, though he has since gotten married, and I hope he has lived a relatively normal, happy life these past 2 decades. But from reading The Raw Truth, I get the impression that Vincent's relationship with his maternal grandparents is a complicated one, because when he filed a lawsuit against his father to claim the proceeds from his mother's life insurance policy, the McKinneys were hoping that the case would go to a civil trial, so Leonard would be forced to answer questions under oath. However, the two sides agreed to an out-of-court settlement, but while I can understand the McKinneys' disappointment over this, it's possible that after experiencing the trauma of losing his mother and older brother and becoming estranged from his father, Vincent just wanted to move on with his life. Since Vincent was still living with his parents prior to Monica's death, I would be curious to know if he ever saw anything suspicious to shed light on what might have happened to her. But he worked long hours at a movie theater at that time, which meant that he often didn't get home until past midnight, and it also sounds like his parents sometimes stayed in the trailer in the backyard. So from the sound of things, not seeing his mother for a long period of time may not have seemed all that unusual for Vincent. Long story short, from reading The Raw Truth, it's very clear that Bill was incredibly frustrated by the San Antonio Police Department's investigation and their inability to build a strong enough case against Leonard to indict him for murder, as Bill felt they pretty much dragged their feet over the whole situation. It does sound like they made some mistakes, as I read a few news articles which stated that after police performed their extensive search of the Rizzo residence, Leonard returned home and discovered that they'd left some crime scene logs there. Yeah, that sounds like a nice way to potentially tip off a suspect about how much evidence they have against him. Bill described Leonard as being someone who always thought he was the smartest person in the room, which is why he was often willing to speak with the media. During interviews, Leonard made it sound like he and Monica had a wonderful, happy marriage and was living their best life at the time she disappeared, even though the couple were in serious financial trouble, their house was in complete disarray, and multiple witnesses said it was obvious that Monica was being abused. I've always remarked about how surprising it was that unsolved mysteries were able to convince so many suspects to appear on camera for interviews to profess their innocence, and Leonard Rizzo is no exception. Of course, Leonard denied the allegations that he abused and murdered Monica, and acted like they were the happiest couple, and when attempting to address the evidence against him, he essentially said, "Gee, I have no idea how those bone fragments wound up in my backyard." And needless to say, I do not buy Leonard's explanation that the holes and blood spatter in the house's drywall were the result of him punching and headbutting the wall in anger over Monica's disappearance, as he literally stated, quote, "I attempted to beat up the house, and the house won." 2 decades ago, Unsolved Mysteries actually released a commercial DVD set titled Bizarre Murders, which featured their segment about this case, and contained a very interesting commentary track by one of the show's co-creators, John Cosgrove, and the segment's director, Mike Mathis. They said that their interview with Leonard was filmed inside his house after the police completely tore it apart, so it was very hard to find a spot to position the camera which did not show extensive damage in the background. And they also confirmed that Leonard's attorney was in the room off-camera in order to ensure that his client didn't say anything too incriminating. While Leonard did not come across particularly well in his interview, I had to concede that he did make one valid point. The segment contained comments from one of the archaeologists who found Monica's bone fragments in the backyard, and since most of them were cut into hundreds of small pieces which were less than 3 inches long, he theorized that a machine like a wood chipper had to be used in order to cause this level of damage. But Leonard responded by saying he had never owned, rented, or operated a wood chipper. Indeed, police looked into this angle and could not find any evidence that Leonard had access to any heavy machinery like this during the time period when Monica was believed to have been killed. So while I definitely believe that Leonard had the motive and opportunity to commit this murder, figuring out the means is a bit more complicated. But let's look at the timeline. We know that Monica worked her last day at the Department of Human Services on May the 5th, as she left abruptly during the middle of the day and never returned. While Unsolved Mysteries tried to portray her actions as mysterious, I learned the full story from the raw truth, as Monica left shortly after Leonard called the office and screamed at the receptionist because he couldn't reach his wife on the phone. I don't know what transpired after Monica returned home, but I'm guessing that Leonard probably threatened her into not returning to work, even though she was the sole breadwinner and the couple were way behind on their bills. I get the sense that there may have been some sort of self-loathing on Leonard's part over the fact that he had been unemployed for several months and his wife was supporting him. The whole situation is incredibly sad, as prior to her disappearance, there was one night where Monica stayed very late at the office until the security guard made her leave because he wanted to lock up the building, and it's suspected that she did this because she was afraid to go home. However, we know that Monica was still alive for weeks after she left work, as she spoke to her supervisor on the phone on May the 13th, was seen with Leonard at Vincent's high school graduation on the 25th, and Vincent claimed that she spoke to him while he was in the shower during the early morning hours of the 27th. We also know that Leonard Jr. was at the residence when police arrived on June the 5th, and Leonard Sr. just happened to be experiencing a seizure when they burst inside. Some of the earliest reporting seemed to allege that Leonard experienced a drug overdose, but his attorney publicly debunked this and said that he had a long history of seizures. Well, in the raw truth, Bill confirms that this was technically true, as Leonard had been experiencing seizures for years, but Bill pretty much described them as being selective seizures, which always seemed to happen or not happen at the most convenient times. When the seizures began, Leonard claimed that this left him unable to drive, which meant that Monica had to chauffeur him around everywhere. But when Leonard wanted to, say, travel 100 miles out of town, he seemed to have no qualms about driving there on his own, and he conveniently never experienced any seizures when he did this. So if you believe Leonard was faking his condition, it's possible that when he heard the police knocking and asking him to open the door, he immediately experienced one of his convenient seizures in order to put off being questioned. Of course, Leonard would later say that Monica had left without explanation days before the police arrived, and he never bothered to report her missing because he figured she would return on her own. This is a pattern of behavior I've seen in so many missing persons cases when a spouse comes under suspicion. You'll often hear about the victim being trapped in a relationship with a jealous, controlling, and possessive spouse who pretty much wanted to know where they were at all times. Yet when the victim vanishes without explanation, said spouse suddenly becomes very blasé about the whole situation and makes no effort to try and find them. Well, the same logic certainly applies towards Leonard, who went from going into an angry rage because he couldn't reach his wife at work to being completely unconcerned about the fact that she disappeared and left her car and all of her personal possessions behind. Months after Monica went missing, her parents learned that sometime prior to her disappearance, she had gotten a tattoo on her back. It was based on a sketch that Leonard created, which featured an image of a warrior princess with his own face in the direct center, and Bill took that as a sign of Leonard attempting to mark Monica as his personal property. However, when Leonard was originally questioned by police, he never mentioned this tattoo, even though you would think that's a very distinct detail he'd want to get out there if he genuinely believed that his wife was a missing person. If the police had not received those anonymous phone calls about Monica's remains being in the backyard, who knows how much more time would have passed before anyone noticed she was missing. Now, I'll admit that when I first learned about this case in Unsolved Mysteries, I wondered if the anonymous caller might have been one of Leonard's sons, who knew what he had done to their mother, but didn't feel comfortable coming forward with a first-hand account. So it was a surprise to learn that the caller was actually a family friend named Robert Acala, who claimed that he noticed the bones in the Rizzo's backyard, and it was pretty creepy to hear him say that he saw a dog playing with Monica's jawbone and recognized it as belonging to her because of the overlapping teeth. You might be wondering why Hakala tried to remain anonymous, but once his identity was made public, he claimed that he was roughed up at a biker bar where Leonard was known to hang out at, so perhaps he felt that coming forward would cause him to be labeled as a snitch. Hakala also expressed his fear that police might be considering him to be a suspect, but while they have never publicly named him as a suspect, I find it interesting how they never flat out said that they ruled him out as a suspect either. So could it be possible that Hakala knew more than he was letting on, and did not just happen to notice Monica's bones in the backyard? After all, when the police performed a cursory search of the yard in June, they didn't find anything until Hakala called them back 1 month later and specifically told them that the remains were concealed beneath some tires. I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into this, because I can't stomach the idea that a guy could murder his wife, chop up her remains, literally scatter them throughout his backyard, and somehow manage to get away with it for nearly 27 years. I mean, these weren't just bones, there were also bags which apparently contained human flesh, and I'm sure this must have created a nauseating smell in the Texas heat in June and July. Even Leonard has said during interviews that if he committed this crime, would he really be stupid enough to just leave his wife's remains lying around the property? Well, Leonard does not strike me as the sharpest tool in the shed, and given what a huge mess his house was at the time, I could totally see him being lazy enough to do this. If so, I doubt it was a premeditated murder, because we know Monica was living in isolation for weeks after she left her workplace, so her death could have been the result of an unplanned confrontation that escalated out of control and led to violence. After all, the holes in the drywall suggest that Leonard may have smashed Monica's head against it in a fit of rage. But once again, I have to harken back to the question of how exactly Leonard chopped up Monica's body into hundreds of pieces without attracting any attention. Obviously, the most famous known crime involving a wood chipper was the murder of Hella Crafts, which took place in Connecticut in November of 1986, and involved her being murdered by her husband, Richard Crafts, who used a wood chipper to dispose of her body. But in this particular case, there was a paper trail to show that Richard had rented the wood chipper and purchased a chainsaw, which was found in a lake, with Hella's hair and blood on it. When Richard was charged with murder and put on trial, the prosecution's theory was that Richard killed Hella by striking her in the head with a blunt instrument, kept her inside a freezer for hours, cut her frozen body apart with the chainsaw, and then fed the pieces into a wood chipper. The evidence was so overwhelming that the state was able to secure a conviction without most of Hella's remains, even though murder trials without the victim's body were far less common during the 1980s. But the Crafts murder took place in the middle of a snowstorm when people would have been very distracted, whereas Monica was likely killed in late May or early June in a middle-class suburban neighborhood. Needless to say, if Leonard had been using a wood chipper or chainsaw on his property during that time period, I'm sure people would have noticed. Of course, even if Monica was killed inside her own house, Leonard could have chopped up her body at an entirely different location, but if so, why not dispose of her remains there rather than scatter them throughout your own backyard? I know that when Leonard was released from the hospital following his so-called seizure, one of the very first things he did was try to seal up the opening to the attic and the garage. While no direct evidence was found to indicate that foul play occurred there, luminol testing did indicate that there may have been large pools of blood on the garage floor at one point, so it's possible that Leonard could have chopped up Monica in there and did this while his son was at work, which is why Vincent was unable to supply any information about what happened. The presence of the bone fragments in the barbecue grill suggests that perhaps Leonard made an unsuccessful attempt to incinerate Monica's remains into nothingness. But once again, I don't believe Leonard would have been able to slice all these bones into such small pieces without some sort of machine, and where's the evidence that he ever used or had access to one? Don't get me wrong, the idea that a completely unknown third party killed Monica and attempted to frame Leonard by spreading her remains around his backyard without him noticing is completely absurd. If this had been a stable, happy marriage, then maybe I could consider this possibility, but not when there's ample evidence of domestic violence. However, I could still see Leonard's defense team trying to push forward the argument about someone planting the remains if he was ever charged with murder and put on trial. This could be a case where Leonard's rampant stupidity and sloppiness actually worked in his favor, because a jury might have a hard time believing that, well, anyone could be that stupid and sloppy. So yeah, while I have very little doubt that Leonard killed Monica, I still can't figure out the circumstances of how she was chopped up so badly that hundreds of bone fragments wound up in their backyard. As frustrating as it might be that the original DNA analysis was faulty and incorrectly identified the remains as belonging to Monica and three other people, you have to remember that DNA testing was still a relatively new thing in criminal investigations back then, and it was nowhere near as advanced as it is today. And it's not like they were working from a fully formed set of remains, as the majority of the bone fragments were less than 3 inches long. I actually cannot imagine what must have been going through Leonard's mind when it was announced that the bones belonged to four different people, as he may have been thinking to himself, "I may be a murderer, but I'm not a full-fledged serial killer." However, this mistake may have worked in Leonard's favor, because it has given his defense team potential ammo to criticize the investigation and generate reasonable doubt if he ever went on trial. And this is the reason why I believe the authorities have always been reluctant to hand down a murder indictment, because they are not completely certain they can secure a conviction. This is obviously a horrible situation for Monica's loved ones, and since Bill McKinney is getting up there in age, I hate the idea of him leaving this earth without getting to witness justice for his daughter. Since Leonard has been out of the spotlight for quite some time, I can't say with 100% certainty that he's still alive, but if he is, he would currently be in his early 70s, so time is running out. The one thing which might break this case wide open is if there's anyone out there who knows something and needs to come forward. So if you happen to have any information about the murder of Monica Rizzo, please contact the San Antonio Police Department at 210-207-7273. That's 210-207-7273. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Also, one final reminder that this coming Saturday, April the 27th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be holding one of our annual Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathons, in which I screen classic segments from the show, and you can watch them and chat with myself and your fellow listeners. If you'd like to join us, you can find the link to our screening room in our show notes and pinned at the top of our social media pages. Once again, it's taking place this coming Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and we hope to see you there. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 6 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released a bonus episode about a wanted fugitive named Carl Alfred Etter, who was convicted of the murders of a mother and her four children when he was only 16 years old, but wound up escaping from prison in 1974 and has not been seen since. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1988 disappearance of Elizabeth Campbell. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I just wanted to remind everyone that The Trail Went Cold will be returning again to the True Crime Podcast Festival this year, which is being held at the Denver Marriott Westminster in Colorado from July the 12th to the 14th. If you would like to purchase tickets, we have a discount code for 15% off, so please visit truecrimepodcastfestival.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's truecrimepodcastfestival.com and the promo code is TRAIL for 15% off tickets. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composed the ear music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.